and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a Scranton girl.
Our previous episodes explored the open seat to replace Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney. Now, I learned a lot from those diverse guests, and I hope you did too. If you haven't tuned in, give a listen. The sprint to the May primary, it's engulfed not only Philadelphia, but also Pittsburgh and Allegheny County. And I don't want to discount all the other county races that are happening across the Commonwealth, but this one's of particular interest to me. Incumbent County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, he's term limited. In January, his successor is going to take on the reins of a workforce of several thousand and a budget of several billion. Now, politically, Allegheny County is upward of 1.2 million residents. It's going to feature prominently in the campaign of whoever becomes our country's next president. With all this in mind, our next episodes are a chance for you to hear directly from the candidates running for county executive. I sat down with each of them more or less simultaneously. The topics of our conversations are also more or less the same. Their answers, though, as you can imagine, are quite different. They each have unique backgrounds and different visions for what they bring to this position. What they do have in common is a deep concern about the future of Pennsylvania's second largest county and a passion to improve the lives of everyday Pennsylvanians. So we're going to start this series of conversations alphabetically. State Rep Sarah Inmorato, she's no stranger to our many listeners in Harrisburg. She's one of the youngest members of the State House. She won her seat in 2018. It's the first time she put her name on the ballot, by the way. Since then, she's been busy 7 days a week as a legislator and seven nights a week as a progressive political organizer. Sarah Inmorato, welcome to my kitchen table.
Hello, how are you?
Well, the question is, how are you? You have a day job in Harrisburg and you have less than 60 days on the campaign trail for county executive.
I'm feeling great. So I'm just, you know, in the swing of living two lives all at once.
Well, listeners have had the chance to hear all sorts of perspectives from your colleagues over the 2+ years of this show from Harrisburg. But today we're going to talk about all the nuts and bolts that go into running a county executive campaign and not necessarily what's happening in Harrisburg. But share with folks your background. You're frankly one of the younger members of my kitchen table. So it's just incredible how much you've accomplished before your 40th birthday.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So, you know, I'm a native daughter of Allegheny County. I never left, never really could afford to leave, I think. And I, you know, went to Pitt, studied business there, graduated peak recession. So I, you know, saw firsthand what it was like to try to, you know, get a job and stabilize myself post-college. And worked in the private sector for a little bit, worked for a big tech company in the retail division and did a leadership program with them. And, you know, during that time, my father passed away from his struggles with addiction. And it really, you know, threw me for a loop and put me on a plane where I had to like reevaluate what I was doing. And I was like, I was ready for a 360 and was like, I need to do something where I can give back to my community, and I want to be doing mission-driven work. I started applying for the Peace Corps and going through that process, which can be pretty intense. And that's why I started doing some volunteer work in the public health space, specifically with Prevention Point Pittsburgh, around like syringe service programs. And thankfully had someone who acted as a mentor to me and really connected me to the nonprofit space. And so I started doing nonprofit work in the like communications and fundraising and policy world, and did that for a number of years, went out on my own and was doing my own consulting with socially minded businesses, nonprofits, and government agencies. And that's how I found politics. I've always been someone who I knew couldn't really afford higher, like graduate level college or a degree. And so I've always sought out opportunities to learn. And I ended up doing a program through Coro Civic Leadership Academy called Women in Leadership. And that's how I got involved in politics. Originally, it was in 2016. And it was early. I say my great political awakening was like 6 months earlier than everyone else's, but still like pretty much on that same trajectory. And I was helping women run for office, because part of the program was like, you have to craft a project that uplifts women in Southwestern PA. And at the time, Pennsylvania was ranked 49th when it came to women in office. And I partnered with some of the members in my cohort, and we designed this program called She Runs to just, you know, remove the shroud of mystery over local politics and helped people access the resources and tools necessary to run for local office. And, you know, at the time I started paying more attention to what was going on in Harrisburg, and I saw that the person who was representing the district that I called home really wasn't at the table at a lot of events and work that I was doing, organizing my community around affordable housing and anti-gentrification, and, you know, decided to find someone to run against him who would embody more of the values of the work that was happening in the community. And, you know, through that process of interviewing folks, they said, well, why don't you run? And I was like, that's not really, that wasn't in the cards for me. But, you know, doing the research on women running for office, knowing that women need to be asked typically 7 times before they run. So I was asked by a number of my community members and decided to walk the talk, or yeah, walk the talk. And, you know,
lots of great points to unpackage there. But just remind folks, so where in the county did you grow up? And now where is your state house district?
So I grew up in an area called Ross Township. I'm a graduate of North Hills High School, and I live in Lawrenceville currently. And I used to represent, before the redistricting process, I used to represent where my childhood home was in Ross Township, where I lived as a teenager in Millville, and then where I was currently living in Lawrenceville. So, but that shifted a little bit over. So I represent parts of the city in the East End and the Strip District, the North Side, and then all of Shaler School District area.
So we have listeners all over the Commonwealth and certainly all over Western PA and even beyond, quite a few in the DC area. So Pittsburgh is very much a city of neighborhoods, and Allegheny County is not just Pittsburgh. It's dozens and dozens, well over 100 actually, townships and boroughs.
130.
So as you're plotting out your foray into 2016, going to put your name on the ballot, I mean, was there one moment? You said it takes 7 times that the kind of the light bulb went off and you said, okay, this is it. Or was there one particular public policy issue, or what was the spark?
I saw what sitting rep was sponsoring, what he was prioritizing, and that was being the leader of the Second Amendment Caucus. He had voted against anti-choice. He was anti-choice. He was writing bills that would require work requirements for SNAP benefits and defunding sanctuary cities. And when I saw that, because I was doing the work on the ground in the nonprofit space, I knew the impact of legislation like that it would have on the people of this region. And so I knew I had a sense of urgency of needing to put new leadership into that position. And I don't think that it was one, I can't point to one time, but it was, you know, interviewing women who I respected and, you know, at the end of the conversation would ask them to run. And they said, well, why don't you run? And about the third time that happened, I had to deeply consider it. And I had to look at the community around me and say, all right, or who's in, right? Who's going to be a part of this? And I said, well, you know, I like building coalitions and I like organizing. So if I just invite more people to participate, that's how democracy should work, right? Like, it wasn't running against a person, it was running for something. And, you know, we made a plan and people bought into it. So that's what kind of got us here.
When we take a look in the last 6 years in Pennsylvania politics and frankly, just our nation's history, there's been all sorts of twists and turns. I mean, 2018, record number of women running, record number of women winning. 2020, democracy stress test, barely passed it. So I guess my point is, Sarah, you've been doing meaningful work in Harrisburg. You've had a front row seat really to American history. At what point did you say, you know what, I'm going to pivot and I'm going to plunge into the county executive race?
Well, I love the work that I've been doing as a legislator. I've been able to draft legislation that really centers working people in this county and across this Commonwealth. I've been able to stand up to corporate bullies. I've been able to work the systems in Harrisburg to deliver resources back to a lot of the municipal leaders and the nonprofits that I represent. I even was able to pass legislation with a Republican majority and, you know, with the passage of the Whole Home Repair Bill. And, you know, the legislative process, it's
tell folks, it is certainly, yes, it's a steep road in Harrisburg, but since you mentioned being in the minority and Democrats, fortunately, are now in the majority, but what was the particular piece of legislation that you worked on?
So it's called Whole Home Repairs. Yeah, I worked with Senator Saval. We found out that we were working. Yes. So we realized we were working on similar legislation. So we took away our egos and said, how do we make a really strong piece of public policy and work together? So we mashed up our bills because mine was called Housing Resiliency Fund. His was Whole Home Repairs. We combined the best parts of the bill. And then we said, okay, how do we push this across the finish line? And we had, you know, we both come from the progressive movements on different sides of the state. So we knew we had that base, but we knew we had to speak to businesses. We had to speak to Republicans. So we built a broad coalition and was able to get that across the finish line. And that's a bill that puts $125 million towards home repairs. But it also creates workforce development, because if you're doing repairs on homes in the residential space, those have to be local jobs. And so it keeps that money flowing in the communities where these repairs are happening. There's also set aside to streamline social services, because so many people who have to access public services have to spend a lot of their time filling out multiple forms, driving somewhere, going to visit it. Their time is taxed. So we wanted to really make it a user-friendly experience, because government can and should be a really positive experience for people when they have to interact with it. And it also reduces our overall energy use. So it's a great tool to combat climate change in a very real way that people understand. So these are the ways we need to think about public policy issues, is from a very deeply intersectional lens. So the Whole Home Repairs really does contain all of that and uses housing as a platform to do that.
So, I mean, to this point, so much comes before the legislature, and for listeners out of state or just getting involved in Pennsylvania politics, it is a full-time legislature and it's quite different than county government. And we've touched on gender equity issues, housing policy issues, addiction issues. So at what point did you say, you know what, I want to pivot to county government, which, don't get me wrong, incredibly important issues, but maybe less in a typical month.
Yeah.
Less, meaning different types of issues, not a quantity of issues that might come across the county executive's plate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, local government, county government, that's where the rubber hits the road. That's their ultimate doer positions. And while I love the theoretical policy making that happens in Harrisburg and coming up with good ideas and playing the long game, I'm a person who likes to take a lot of action. And so the pivot from legislator to an executive role like the county executive seems like a natural fit in the work that I was doing before, but also getting to take this experience connection from the state house. And we've seen it time and time again. The mayor of Pittsburgh, Mayor Ed Gainey, he was a former colleague. Lieutenant Governor Austin Davis, former colleague. Even Governor Shapiro, he served in the state legislature. We never served together, but he comes from that space. So,
Actually, was at a canvas kickoff in maybe October 2004 with my first boss, Howard Dean.
Oh, wow.
Many, many, many moons ago. But yeah, he was running also to one seat. It was a Republican held seat. Let me ask you, my understanding is you're doing aggressive canvassing and you've got a great field team from friends up there that I hear. What are you hearing at the doors? I mean, we've touched on all different policy issues, but what's top of mind? And frankly, does it change as you go neighborhood to neighborhood and township to township?
Well, I think just to add on a little bit to the last question, you know, part of what I've done after passing the whole home repairs is stayed involved in the conversation. So we got the bill across the finish line. I could have taken my victory lap, but it's like, okay, now we have to deploy the program at a county level. So we've been meeting with 40 plus organizations to design a program that can really meet the needs of the people who are here in this county, but also fit into the current programs that already exist. So not to duplicate efforts, but to add to the efforts and make sure that everyone's kind of working together to deliver quality services in the most impactful way possible. And so that, like, that's just another appeal of it, like seeing like what happens in Harrisburg and being able to translate that to a county level program is something that we've been able to do. And I say that around field because it is something that comes up at the doors all the time. People may not know me, but they actually know about the home repair program and know that it's coming. And we hear that all across the county, you know, especially in neighborhoods. Well, actually all across the county, because it can happen in Lawrenceville, where it's actually a rapidly gentrifying and becoming a wealthier neighborhood. We hear it for folks who have lived there for a long time. And we also hear it in neighborhoods where there maybe are higher levels of blight and, you know, more of a need to stabilize the housing stock as opposed to prevent displacement and gentrification. But, you know, housing is definitely something that comes up in many forms, whether people are asking about homelessness or seniors are concerned about, you know, being able to pay their bills every month and being able to stay in their home and age either in the place that they've called home for a long time or at least in their community. We're hearing a lot about mental health and the need for, you know, really comprehensive, responsive mental health supports. You know, we passed 988, which is the emergency number you dial if you're in a mental health crisis, but we just really don't have a good delivery system to make sure we're meeting that. But then also how we're thinking about helping people upstream before they get to a crisis point. And then also a lot around shared prosperity, right? We've seen a lot of development deals. You know, we're not the Pittsburgh of 25 years ago. We've modernized in a number of ways. We're on our third renaissance, I believe, maybe going into our fourth. We've had many renaissances. What's the plural of renaissance?
I don't know. I was bad at grammar.
Well, but I was like,
keep them coming. I mean, it's incredible to think in your lifetime, my lifetime, how much has changed
exactly.
In the county, in the city.
It's incredible.
And for that matter, the number of international delegations and conferences often sponsored by the U.S. federal government, because it is amazing renaissance or sances.
Yeah, we have a lot of really great things to show off here. You know, we've become the eds and meds and the tech, but we've also grown inequality in the process. So while we've reinvented ourselves, that reinvention and that inviting of resources and development and shining a light on our region, it has not led to stabilization of families across the region. The United Way does a really good job about giving us a new way to measure need in households. So normally you'd look at like, oh, what's our poverty rate? And our poverty rate is around 10%, which is in line with what the rest of the Commonwealth is. But if you look at this United Way report, which is called ALICE, which is asset limited, income constrained, and employed individuals, essentially working families, and what it means, what the percentage of those households are living paycheck to paycheck, you're looking at around 38%. And that's data from before COVID. So if you're talking about the precarity that households are experiencing across this region and across this Commonwealth, like that's where we really have to be intentional as policymakers to ensure that, you know, people aren't going to fall through the cracks because they're just one medical bill away from catastrophe. They're just one, you know, large utility bill away from, you know, not being able to stay in their home or be able to put food on the table. So, you know, people are feeling that, especially like that coupled with inflation and what's going on and, you know, seeing that you know, we're adding jobs in like the higher pay scale or in the lower pay scale. So, you know, we're not really hitting that median income job creation and creating pathways for opportunity for people. So, you know, making sure that as we're inviting development and job creators into this region, that they're being able to provide jobs that are family sustaining for the people of this region and stabilizing.
So, as you know, I'm originally from the Lehigh Valley. We can argue where the organized labor and the Industrial Revolution began, whether it was in the valleys out there or the valleys in the eastern part. But Pennsylvania certainly is the birthplace of organized labor. I think we can agree on that. And you've been endorsed by SEIU, the Army of Purple and Gold. And maybe you can just speak to their role in this campaign and their role in the community. Many, many moons ago, it seems like during the mayor's primary, we did sit down with the leadership of SEIU, had a great discussion, but they're certainly a force in Pennsylvania politics and certainly mm-hmm. Western PA politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're proud to have the support of labor in our campaign. And so we're endorsed by SEIU, healthcare, 32BJ, and 668. So we have the trifecta. So essentially the three separate unions. And 668 is really vital because they represent about 1,000 employees in the county. So, you know, for them, their priorities are ensuring that their members have a family sustaining wage. Public employment has always been a pathway to the middle class. And because of austerity mindset we've had over the last couple of decades, we've equated like paying public servants a living wage is not necessarily a priority. So, you know, looking at the quality of life from many angles for our county workforce is super vital to our campaign. And they saw that with healthcare, you know, it's ensuring that, you know, our giant hospital system, UPMC, is really paying their fair share and allowing.
I don't know who these listeners are, but we might have some listeners who don't know what that is, and shame on them.
Sure.
They are one of the largest employers in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
I believe that they are the largest private employer in the Commonwealth. So they have been moving eastward from Pittsburgh for quite some time. So
UPMC, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Okay, sorry, continue.
It's often held up nationally as a great example of them abusing market dominance. And it's a great study on antitrust and monopolization of healthcare and kind of what that delivers for people and how it decreases health outcomes and increased costs for regular people and also decreases the quality of life and suppresses wages for workers within that system. So
that being said, I definitely understand that argument, but my previous boss, Senator Casey's father, the late governor, had a remarkable mm-hmm. dual transplant, compliments of surgeons, the medical professionals at UPMC. Granted, that was many, many moons ago, but it is world-class medicine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's, you know, I think we can separate the corporate activities from the people who actually deliver care within that system. And people really love their doctor. They love their nurses and the aides that bring them that care every day. And we've seen that public consciousness increase, and people have really been standing with their healthcare providers and saying that they really want to see more out of the leadership within that hospital and a reinvestment of all the profits that they're making back into the community and back into the people who are actually delivering that care. You know, so folks are able to kind of separate the two of like, this is my doctor I see. And yes, I have UPMC insurance. I go see a UPMC doctor. Like my doctor, I want to continue to see her. And also, I would really like UPMC, instead of opening hospitals abroad, to be able to invest back into the people who provide me care and provide my family care.
No, I was going to say, you've been super generous with your time. You got less than 60 days of a sprint, so I'm gonna let you off the hook soon. But I do have two final questions, Sarah. You mentioned the county workforce, which my understanding is close to 1,000. And if there's one issue nowadays that's uniting Democrats and Republicans here in Washington, it's TikTok. And being one of the youngest forces and faces in Pennsylvania politics, I'd be curious your thoughts on TikTok and the county workforce and county devices. I know that as we're recording this, the TikTok CEO is probably going through all sorts of prep, getting ready to testify before the Congress.
Yeah. I'm on the younger side, but I still am not like the most social media savvy person at times. You know, I've stayed off of TikTok until now because of, you know, the security risks that have, you know, been talked about and reported on.
Has this come up in Harrisburg, by the way? Has the legislature weighed in on this?
Not in a meaningful way. I believe that it will. Like, we've seen some changes to the names of committees to deal more with emerging technologies, like, you know, social media and talking about data protection and data privacy and how it can become a weak point. But it's also like TikTok's nothing new, right? We know, I feel like a few years ago, I was working on an issue, you know, around surveillance and license plate surveillance and public surveillance with cameras, and like, who owns that data? Where does it live? How is it protected? How is it accessed? How can it be abused? How do we prevent that abuse? And a lot of that ties back to, you know, our civil liberties and our right to privacy. So, and also like how a lot of this equipment, you know, so there were weaknesses in it. If it was ordered, you know, it came from China. So there was a lot of, it was connected in a number of different ways. So, you know, I definitely think that it's something that we need to look into and, you know, make a sound policy decision based on, you know, what the research is telling us. And well, if you're using
quite, it's quite possible the federal government might do this job before January of next year, should you be sworn in.
Yeah.
All right. So final question. If you're sworn in, and, you know, it's crazy we're already thinking about this, but November 2024 is going to be here before we know it, less than 600 days. And election administration, it isn't partisan. It really has not been something that we've talked much about, but you have people running for county office all around the country who have some very unique theories, in my opinion, very damaging theories about how we should administer elections in mm-hmm. this country. And I'm just curious your thoughts. It's a relatively small, I think, department of county government, but it's certainly going to be, I think, in the bullseye as we see Governor DeSantis, for example, getting ready to come to a statewide conference with some of your colleagues in Harrisburg. So mm-hmm. I wanted to end on this note about the future of our democracy and how fragile it is and the role that county government plays in strengthening it.
Yeah, and county government actually plays a giant role in Pennsylvania and the administration of free and fair elections. You know, at the county level, I think we've set a really good precedent in Allegheny County on mail-in ballots and making sure that they're collected and counted in a timely way. We've seen, you know, at the end of election day, most of results were present because of the very tight ship that the current administration ran when it came to ensuring that ballots were counted. They went through a really robust process to try to get folks the information so they could cure their ballots if there was a missing signature or a missing date. You know, I think continuing that legacy is very important to me in entering this role, but also thinking about how do we expand access to the ballot box and to voting. And, you know, what we've seen, there's been a lot of conversation around drop boxes, and there are other counties that utilize them. And I believe that, you know, we have one drop box right now. It's downtown. It's the elections office. You're bound by work hours. So, you know, how can we use places that are already equipped with security features, like schools, for example, that can act as places where people can drop off their ballot? And so we do have a key role to play in the not only the security of our elections, but the efficiency of them, and then the access that people have, and how do we expand the electorate by removing as many barriers as possible for people to participate in voting.
That was a great note to end on. And I think hopefully, regardless of who the candidates are for president, whoever's on the ballot next November, it should be a record turnout in Allegheny County and across the Commonwealth. So, Sarah, thanks for taking the time and taking the plunge into this race.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. Take a minute and leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform. Please also consider following us on social media for updates and announcements regarding future episodes and new guests. You're political, so I am sure that you're on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. We are too. At PA Political Podcast. Visit our website, papoliticalpodcast.org, and send us your feedback about this episode and suggestions on future guests. Until next week.